we're in the Advent season, and the prophet Isaiah, who we're going to teach from tonight, is kind of like the king of the Advent season. He has so many prophecies about the coming of Messiah that, you know, there's, I try to rotate him year by year. And this year we're going to go with A Light Has Shone, because there's at least, I don't know, I've never counted them. There's probably at least a dozen amazing prophecies, because Isaiah, whose Hebrew name is Yeshayahu, who is the greatest of the major prophets, he has 66 chapters. It's pretty amazing. Of course, he didn't write them as chapters, but, you know, up in heaven, when Isaiah meets some of those other prophets, he says, I had 66 chapters. How many did you have? Three? Did you write that all in 1 hour? No, he doesn't do that. But anyway, he covers a terrific amount of time, like a whole time span of history of the people. But he's best known for the passages that, you know, since the ancient times of the church, it's been called Advent, waiting for the coming of the Lord. And tonight we're going to go to Isaiah chapter 9. And what's going to be interesting here is you have to keep in mind that there was, that the kingdom split after King Solomon died. Okay, it split. The northern kingdom was called Israel. The southern kingdom was called Judah. Judah basically consisted of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And the northern kingdom of Israel consisted of all the rest. They got mixed up with all kinds of idolatry. They were surrounded by Gentiles. And we're going to see there were some snotty references to the Galilee by the people in the south. And they called it the Galilee of the Gentiles, which we think that sounds cute. But at the time, that was a big insult, because they were surrounded by Gentile nations. They led a very simple life. It was agricultural and fishing. There were no centers of learning in the Galilee. There were seven synagogues in the whole Galilee, which is really big. And we know that Jesus spent most of his time there. And we're going to read some of these scriptures and then talk about how this light comes out of this place that everybody in the rest of Israel thought was dark. Okay, eventually, the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, fell in 722 BC, was overrun by the Assyrians. And they basically moved in. Some of the people got deported, but mostly they intermarried with the Assyrians, and they became the ancestors of the Samaritans. And this is why the people in the land of Judah couldn't stand Samaritans, because they were half-breeds. And they changed a lot of the theology. But needless to say, it hasn't happened yet when Isaiah is writing this, but he's prophesying that is happening too. And it happened after the death of Solomon with Rehoboam and Jeroboam. But you have to read that for your homework. We can't explain that in 15, 20 minutes. So Isaiah 9. Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed, as when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, and afterwards more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan in the Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined, or we would say shone. So what is he talking about here? The lands of Zebulun and Naphtali, you know, the 10 tribes, the 10 fallen tribes were mostly in the, were all in the north. These were the ones that eventually will become the Samaritans. So there's a gloom over the whole place. And in the land of Zebulun is where Nazareth was located. In the land of Naphtali is where Capernaum was located. So this is Isaiah prophesying that even though this place is kind of distressed and gloomy, the lands of Zebulun and Naphtali, something's going to happen there. The Galilee of the Gentiles. See, this was a big insult to the area. They weren't Gentiles, but they were called the Galilee of the Gentiles because these people were influenced by the non-Jews, by the Gentiles around them. In fact, later on, the reason the Jews hated the Samaritans so much is the Samaritans became a product of the northern kingdom. Okay. But this was after the Assyrians came in. They intermarried with the Assyrians. That was a big no-no. They believed that they had the God of Israel was their God, but he was God there. And all these other people had their own gods, and those were legitimate gods too. But God, the God of Israel, as we would call him, they saw as their God. So the people in the kingdom of Judah, which was the southern kingdom, couldn't stand that. So even though they had the Torah, they had the books of Moses, but they didn't have any of the prophets, just to set the history of the thing. So these were people who walked around in darkness, and they're going to see a great light. Because Messiah is going to grow up in the land of Zebulun. He's going to live most of his adult, well, I shouldn't say most of his adult life. He's going to live the 3 years of his ministry in the land of Naphtali, which was currently dark, was previously dark, but now they're going to see a great light. Now, Isaiah writes this like 700 years before Jesus was born. So how cool is that? So a light shines on them. So the people there had kind of turned away. They were influenced by the surrounding Gentiles. They were, Isaiah calls them less esteemed. They were less esteemed. You know, the history is very messy. If you read through, you know, the Kings and the Chronicles, you kind of get the idea. These northern people were kind of like, oh, well, you know, we don't have to be strict about anything. We can just let things go. We know the temple is down there in Jerusalem, but hey, you know what? We got our own priests. We got our own kings. We got our own holy places. We don't have to do everything they say. And when Jesus discusses all this with the Samaritan woman, the woman at the well, we should do that some night. That's one of my favorites. You know, when he discusses this, you kind of get this idea. The woman says, well, you have nothing to do with us. And he says, well, we worship what we know. You worship what you don't know. You know, you guys are wrong. We're the ones that are right. And they get into this discussion. And they were less esteemed. And it says there in that passage that they walked in darkness. They had the Torah. They had the books of the law. But they didn't recognize any of the prophets. And so basically, and this is oversimplifying it, they weren't sure how many gods there were, but the God of Israel was their God, and so they were going to be focused on him. As a result of not knowing how many gods there are, their kings, once the kingdom split, married women from all these other places who brought more gods into the picture. And they did things that they weren't allowed to do. They followed things, you know, Jezebel's a good example. We can't possibly go over all that unless we had about 6 weeks. But they walked in darkness. And it was called the Galilee of the Gentiles. Now, you know how we make fun of people and we have sarcastic names for places? The people of the southern kingdom called it the Galilee of the Gentiles. That's a huge insult. Because there were 10 tribes living there. But the people in the south basically said, you guys are just like Gentiles. So very insulting. Galil HaGoyim. And this is where the valley of the shadow of death was that is talked about in Psalm 23 and some other places. They didn't worship at Jerusalem. They didn't keep the feasts, the pilgrimage feasts in Jerusalem. They had corrupted even the Torah, which they claimed to follow. Okay, so that's kind of the picture. But God says through Isaiah, they're going to see a light. The light is that must live there for almost all his earthly life. Many, many years in Nazareth in the land of Zebulun. 3 years in Capernaum, the land of Naphtali, which he ended up cursing, by the way. Yes, no. He curses Capernaum, Chorazim, and Bethsaida. He said, no one will ever live here again because you didn't recognize the time of your visitation. And he tells the people in Capernaum that, man, if Sodom and Gomorrah would have seen what you guys see, they would have been converted. But you guys are too dopey for that. And so Bethsaida's a bunch of ruins. Chorazim is a bunch of ruins to this day. Capernaum, nobody lives there. There's a monastery. So I guess you could say, you know, 10 or 20 monks live there. But people don't live there as a city. And there's just the whole rest of the city is a bunch of ruins. But it's a cool place to go. So they're going to see a great light. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. So it's a place of darkness, but there's going to be rejoicing there because Messiah is going to live there. This is 700 years before Messiah is born. Okay, this is prophetically saying something big is going to happen there. There's going to be a light there. Men are going to rejoice there. So that's where salvation is going to show itself. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to Nazareth, but Nazareth is 90% Muslim. All the Christian holy sites are kind of up on a, well, more than a hill, but not quite a mountain, high part of the city. Remember when they were going to throw Jesus off the precipice of the mountain? That's in Nazareth. And now it's 90% of the city is Muslim. And there's a lot of anti-Christian advertisements all over the city. It's kind of scary to walk around there, actually. Canaan, too. But up on the high part of the city, there's all the Christian sites and the places where Jesus, you know, grew up and so forth. So salvation is going to show itself there. And salvation is going to come in this place where there's darkness. They've been living in darkness and they're going to see a great light. So in this place where they're living in darkness, Jesus is going to go live. He's actually going to grow up there. Going to go to Jerusalem, you know, for the pilgrimage feasts and maybe some other times, but he's going to live there. You know, we're used to reading about, you know, kind of the end of his life where he's in Jerusalem a little bit more, but he lived up in the land of Zebulun for a long time. Long time. And great joy is going to come from this. And the Hebrew there means it's going to be a holy joy. Because of this light that's going to shine there, because salvation is going to come from there, this is going to be a place of great joy. Cana is another place that's probably 98% Muslim, and it's really congested, a lot of traffic. There's no place to park. And then there's a beautiful Orthodox church and a beautiful Catholic church kind of up on a hill. And depending on where you park the car, it's a little intimidating to walk through the town. But of course, in those days, it was dark for other reasons. But, you know, there's going to be a holy joy in these places because this points to the gospel. This points to the fact that Yeshua Jesus is going to live in these places. He's going to grow up in Nazareth. He's going to go to the synagogue in Nazareth. He's going to live in Capernaum, the 3 years of his ministry, the great synagogue at Capernaum, where all of John chapter 6 takes place. You can read that for your homework. The bread of life discourse happens in the synagogue at Capernaum. It comes right out and says, this was in the synagogue at Capernaum. And he lived there right by the sea in Peter's house. And so he spends a lot of time in this area. So it says, you know, the gospel of grace is going to be centered here. Even though it's a place of darkness and death, spiritual death, place of darkness and death, this is where the light of the gospel is going to come from. Because he is the light. And it's going to bring great joy. And of course, it's going to bring abundant life. Because he's going to be the light that shatters not only the darkness there, but even the darkness in Northern Ohio, even the darkness in Bolivia, even the darkness in Australia, even the darkness in, I don't know, anywhere else you can name. And that's what he's going to do there. So the joy, that the word that's used for joy there means this multiplied, exciting joy, which is going to be like so exciting because people are going to go from the darkness of sin to light. You know, we go because of what happened there, because of the ministry there before he went to Jerusalem. We understand from his teaching how we're going to go, we go from the darkness of sin to the light. In this place that was so looked down on, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Nathaniel says. Remember? It was pretty cool in the Chosen, too. You know? I love that scene where Philip and Nathaniel are in Nathaniel's house, and Philip's telling him, oh, you know, come and see. And Nathaniel's like, Galilee, Nazareth. They live with their animals inside the house. You know, there's nothing there. I forgot what else, you know, insults it over and over again. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? So it goes from the darkness of sin to light because of what happens, because of the teaching, we realize that we're all living in a great darkness. It doesn't matter where you live. If you're kind of a normal person in Bolivia and you're working at whatever your thing is, you're living in darkness because you're a sinner. If you're living in the most beautiful parts of Beverly Hills and you have a 18,000 square foot house and you got 15 cars and you got $50 million in the bank, you're still a dark, miserable sinner. If you don't know Yeshua Jesus, you're a dark, miserable sinner. And we realize because of how the way this is stated, these people are living in darkness. They're going to see a great light because he's going to live there. He's going to basically proclaim the gospel there. You know, when you read through the gospel, most of it is of the events that happened in the Galilee. Not in the temple. A little bit happens in the temple. Jesus never even stayed at the temple. He always left. Always left. Go on the Mount of Olives and stay. Go out of the city and stay. So when we realize that we're living in this great darkness and then this light comes in, you have more joy and more thankfulness. I mean, you've all met Jesus, and so you know when you met him, you realize what darkness you've been living in. And man, oh man, you know, I always use the example, I hate to pick on Beverly Hills, but, you know, it's a pretty godless place. But you can pick anything. I mean, you know, if you stand on, I don't know, what was it, Rodeo Drive, if you're in the middle of Beverly Hills, and you have all these beautiful stores, and there's all these beautifully dressed people, and there's all these fancy cars, and there's all these mansions you can see in the distance. If you walk up and down the street and you say to those people, you know, you people are living in darkness, they would say, dude, are you crazy? Look, here's my car. Look at this cool outfit I just bought. Look at my house, is that one right over there. And it's only 16,000 square feet. What do you mean living in darkness? The sun's out here almost all the time. You wouldn't get a very good reception there. So, but when you realize that you are in the darkness and now the light comes into the picture, that makes for joy and thankfulness. You know how many times in my life I've said to myself, well, I've said in kind of a prayer, thank you, Lord, for not having me die when I was 42. And I wasn't a believer until I was almost 44. I mean, if I had died before that, I'd be in hell now saying, I can't believe I'm here. What? This isn't fair. Wait a minute. But this is what happens. It makes for joy and thankfulness when the light comes in. And it's multiplied in the nations. The Hebrew word there is goyim, the nations. A goy is anybody who's not a Jew, right? It's what we would call the Gentile. Goyim is plural. So the Gentile nations are also going to experience this. Here we are. I don't think anybody here is a Jewish believer, right? You're all Gentile believers. Yeah. I'm 3%, but we won't count that. That's probably within the margin of error. Yeah. It turns out that all my little 3% Jewish DNA comes on my mother's side. And when I've done these DNA things on two different sites, she matches up people who match up with Jewish names in Eastern Europe and in different places in the U.S. And they get identified as having common DNAs, which is pretty amazing because my people, you know, they lived in a little village in Italy and never went more than 20 miles from the place. But somebody went somewhere. Well, anyway, Joan had the idea years ago that, you know, one of my maternal ancestors was in the Roman army because we come from kind of south central Italy. So there was some guy in the Roman army who got stationed in the Holy Land, and he brought an Israelite woman home with him, either as a slave or as a wife or as a mistress or whatever, and they became my ancestors. And I'm starting to believe maybe that was true, but anyway. So the Hebrew word is about the Gentile nations, and it says everyone is going to rejoice, not just Israel. I mean, here we are, Advent season, couple of weeks till Christmas, commemorate the birth of the Messiah. Unless you're a Messianic Jew, then you don't usually do that, which that's another story. We can talk about my frustration with that some other time. I don't care when he was born, but you can commemorate the fact that he was in fact born. And he's born as this light that Isaiah's talking about that's going to extend to everybody. I mean, here we are, a bunch of Gentiles in Northern Ohio, celebrating the fact that Messiah was born. Our ancestors knew nothing about all that stuff. Our ancestors, wherever you're from, weren't sitting around in their villages in Europe going, oh boy, I hope one of those Jewish evangelists gets here pretty quick. I want to hear what's going on in Jerusalem. I want to hear if there's any messiahs or anything. No. And the Philippines too, sorry. but you probably have Spanish blood too. Yeah. So no matter where you lived in the world, you know, people weren't sitting around in Greece and in present-day Turkey and in Italy. They weren't sitting around going, I wonder when that Saul of Tarsus is going to get here so we can have some church. No, they were going about their own lives and came to faith in the Jewish Messiah. How cool is that? So everyone's going to rejoice, not just Israel. Not just Israel. You know, in Jesus' time, there were people called righteous Gentiles. Cornelius would have been one. The guy who built the synagogue, the guy who approached Jesus and said, you know, come and heal my servant. You don't even have to come. Just say the word from here and he'll be healed. You know, there were Romans there who understood that this was different than their religion. They weren't worshiping 128 gods. They thought this made more sense. And, you know, the Jews called them righteous Gentiles. Cornelius is probably the best example. But faith comes even in the community of the Goyim. It's multiplied in the nations. Verse 4, For you have broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder. The rod of his oppressor is in the day of Midian. You know, we're all yoked to sin. It's our nature. We're yoked to it. We can't escape from it. We can't undo. We can't say, well, for the next 18 days, I'm not going to commit one single sin. You won't even last 18 minutes. You'll violate the law, I'm sure, within 18 minutes, certainly within 18 hours. You can't do it for one day. And so it's a burden. It's a yoke. Like you put on animals, where it's our nature. We have a fallen nature. And so that is going to be smashed. The Hebrew words there refer back to the slavery in Egypt. And they're talking about the same language that's used, that there'll be a future deliverance. You know, this is going to be broken. This burden is going to be broken. The yoke's going to be broken. The taskmaster is not going to be able to whip you anymore. In fact, Paul writes it in Galatians 4, maybe, you know, about how the law of Moses, is the taskmaster that drives us to the cross. I think it's chapter 4. But, you know, it's kind of like the hard schoolmaster that takes you to the cross, because you realize, I can't do this. I can't deal with all my sins anymore. I can't live like this anymore. I can't be good even if I try to be good. I can be good for a couple hours and then I do something outrageous again. That's just... And so it's a, you know, the law of, Paul says, the law is the taskmaster that drives you to the cross. So when you finally realize, I can't do this on my own. I'm not going to have all my sins forgiven by giving a dollar to the homeless guy or saying an extra prayer at night or spending, you know, an hour and 5 minutes in church instead of an hour and 3 minutes in church or saying just the right prayer over here, or just the right prayer over there. That's not going to make up for even one of my sins if there's not a redeemer. So future deliverance is being celebrated because we're all slaves to sin. And the writer calls, Isaiah calls it a yoke and a burden. It's on us all the time. And you've probably heard people say, oh, I don't do anything wrong. I don't commit any sins. And you've probably all heard that, right? I've never killed anybody. I've never stolen anything. And that's when you do this little, well, I wouldn't recommend you do it unless you know the person real well. But, you know, this kind of a, it's humorous, but it's serious, where you say, you know, have you ever sworn and used God's name? Well, in vain? Oh, yeah, of course. Did you ever tell anybody a lie? Well, I mean, not even a little lie. Well, yeah, I mean, everybody tells lies here and there. Have you ever stolen anything? No. You never stolen anything? You never took some staples home from the office, or you didn't take a box of pens home? Or, well, I mean, well, yeah, I guess I have. You ever looked at another woman with lust? Well, I mean, you know, I'm only human. Exactly. Well, and then you say, well, so far we've established that you're a blasphemer, a liar, a thief, and an adulterer. And we're just getting started. You know, you may think you're pretty holy, but you're not as holy as you think. It's a yoke and it's a burden. It's a taskmaster. And it ultimately, for us, and hopefully through our influence for others, it's a taskmaster that drives you to the cross. A similar word was used by rich families in Greece and in Rome that had slaves that would take their kids to school. I forgot what the word was in Latin and Greek, but it's like the image of, you got to take these kids to where they're going to learn and be straightened out. It's kind of like the same idea. So these are broken by the Messiah. He's going to smash those things, it says. It doesn't say you're going to smash them yourself if you say the right kind of prayers, maybe a couple of more prayers per day, maybe give an extra dollar to the Salvation Army guy. And you should do all those things. Maybe, you know, don't curse the guy who cuts you off in the traffic. I wouldn't be able to do that for an hour. But, you know, we're not going to do those things, except we're going to do it by his power. We need that to be delivered from our sinful life. It's not going to be from us. So the gospel breaks that yoke. You know, a yoke is something that's heavy and it's on the animals and holds the animals together. You know, Jesus says, you know, I'll take your yoke. Now you take my burden, I'll take your burden. My burden's light, you'll be able to handle it. I'll take your burden. I can handle your burden, you can't. You can't handle your burden. You can't undo even one sin you've ever committed by being nice to somebody for a half hour. You've probably met people that say, well, I don't do anything wrong. I've never killed anybody. So he breaks the yoke. And, of course, delivers us from the ceremonial law, all 613 of them. And the gospel says, in the epistle say, we have liberty, we have freedom, because the yoke is smashed. Is the law bad? Absolutely not. What is the problem? We can't keep the law. Can't keep the law. So that's what makes us adopted children of the Father. It's good to say as many prayers and communicate with God all day long, as long as all night long. If you're like me and you don't sleep, whatever it is, that's great. Read the scripture, that's great. But to become an adopted child, you're not going to be that by doing those things. Without the Messiah, none of that can be done. Verse 6, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. I always hear this around Christmas time, right? Handel's Messiah, and I love that song. I mean, I love that part of it, the Hallelujah chorus. And so a child is born and a son is given. The eternal son, capital S, is given. The eternal son, Yeshua, Jesus, has always existed. A child is born who's human, Jesus of Nazareth, who didn't always exist in humanity. He takes humanity on. Right? Yes. And the government's going to be on his shoulder. And he's going to be all these things. So a child is born and a son is given. And a son with a capital S. So there's no question about this. A prophetic thing has been done. The prophecies start in Genesis, go through all the Torah, as we're seeing, and then go through all the prophets and end up in Bethlehem of Judah. Jesus, Yeshua, had to be born in humanity, or else he couldn't die, couldn't shed blood. We'd still be in our sin. The writer to the Hebrews, the blood of bulls and goats has no power to take away sin. Those things are prefigurements. So a prophetic thing has been done. It says the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. the plan of salvation that starts in Genesis 3:15 and basically ends with the last sentence of Revelation is all this plan of salvation. The angels fall, a third of them fall. What plan of salvation is there for them? None. None. There's nothing Satan can do to be saved. Do you ever think of that? Nothing a demon can do to be saved. Adam and Eve fall. We get not only the whole scripture, but the second person of the Trinity takes on human nature so that we can be saved. If you don't think about that 20 times a day, you don't get it. So the words made flesh and dwells among us is basically what he's saying there. And he's Emmanuel, God with us. Emmanuel, God with us. You know, he comes in the first chapter of John where it talks about the word was made flesh and dwelt among us. You know, the Greek means he pitched his tent with us. He like bought the house next door. You know, you go to the grocery store and you see him there with his cart. Your kids are outside playing. He comes out and says, "Hi, kids." You can't get your car started. He comes over with the jumper cables. He lives with us. I love that scene in The Chosen where he's like working on some guy's cart and he's fixing the wheel and he's puts it back in place and he puts the grease on it and says, "Okay, try it now. I think it will work." I love that. So he dwells among us. So this is what we're going to commemorate with this Christmas time, with this nativity time. Because the Word is made flesh. Doesn't matter when he was born. You know, if you die tonight and you go to heaven and you'll probably spend, I don't know, a billion of our years being amazed at everything that you see. And then you'll be able to see Yeshua Jesus because he's got a human body. And I don't know how you're going to perceive everything else that we know about. But, you know, you might ask him, when were you actually born on earth? You might want to ask him. I want to know. And if he says, "Actually, it was December 25th. You say, "Cool." If he says it was April 3rd, you say, "Cool." If he says it was October 10th, great. I don't care when he was born. And this is always, you know, when I was working, I always found this was a good time to inject the gospel into people who would come in and go, "Oh, I don't have nearly all my stuff done." And now, stuff done? What in the world are you doing? This is one of many, 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 many Isaiah prophecies, and we've tried kind of rotating them, and the radio shows have kind of been rotating them. So this is the one for this year. Now, since we're not going to be meeting Christmas Eve night, I want to wait for Santa. No, just kidding. Christmas Eve night, which is a Friday, and New Year's Eve night, which is a Friday. And we'll meet next week, but then the next meeting won't be till whatever the first Friday of January is. There'll be that break there where you'll have a chance to think about some of these things and think about how you approach your friends and your neighbors who are running around with 18,000 lights and 18,000 things to do and 1,500 recipes of things they're going to make. And by the way, I always told all my diabetic patients, if you make Christmas cookies or people give you Christmas cookies, just dispose of them by bringing them here and I'll take care of them because it's not good if you eat them.